something. Welcome back, everyone. This is the panel discussion on what is Web 2.0. I hope it's also a little Vesuvius moment where all the questions you've had have been unable to ask because we crammed all of these presentations into 2 days will suddenly erupt. And it'll be a time of great catharsis for you as you're able finally to put the questions out that you've been waiting to ask. We took a while to think about what the panel discussion topic should be. It's one of those things when you've got Cyprian Lomas, Rachel Smith, and John Udell together, what could it not be? We could do anything from probably, you know, scuba diving to multivariate calculus. Jeff's not here, I hope. Is he? He'll correct one.
10 minutes.
Yeah, we'll do 10 minutes. Yeah, the mathematician's like, oh, that's pretty good. So we talked and we thought and we thought and we talked, and one of the first ideas that came up was an idea centering around this meme, I guess you'd call it now, of Web 2.0. And it's something that, while it's been out in the land for a little bit, is relatively new, I think, in some education arenas. One of the ways we knew that this might be something that would work out well is that a number of people, seeing what was up with our publicity for Faculty Academy, said, what is Web 2.0? What do you mean by that? So we thought maybe that would be, in the end, a useful way to focus a discussion on all of the changes and some of the new paradigms coming in the way we experience these information technologies in our lives and vice versa. So, that said, this panel discussion is devoted to the question, what is Web 2.0? A little context for you. It's controversial. Some people say it's so vague as to be meaningless. Many vendors have already decided that it's a good thing to advertise. So they can advertise whatever.
Web 2.0 compliant.
Web 2.0 compliant. As if there is a standards agency certifying Web 2.0, like the Underwriters Laboratory. No. Some people say that it's so selectively applied that it doesn't work well as a description. Bruce Sterling has said that it's hype, but that hype is not the opposite of truth. He says hype is a system call on your attention, which is geek speak for something happened and made your brain go, huh? So what is Web 2.0? If there is a Web 2.0, what does it mean? Where is it headed? What was Web 1.0? Did we miss that? What might Web 3.0 be? So what I'll do is just very informally ask each of our panelists just speak about what is Web 2.0, just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Let's go to that side.
Draw straws if you
can. So I'll start. So I think it's a way of calling attention to what the original intention of the web was. We're having this conversation at lunch, but I think maybe a lot of people don't realize that Tim Berners-Lee was, in fact, a physicist who was an academic who was collaborating with other physicists, and that the invention of the web was a means of being able to collaborate with his academic peers. It was a way to publish and share papers. That is the essence of the web, and we lost sight of it for a period of time. And for a variety of reasons, it got diverted in the direction more of, I would say, television or mainstream media, right? It became a producer-to-consumer relationship instead of a two-way relationship, and this is just the reassertion, I think, of that original impulse.
Well, we're not going to interest them by fighting a lot.
Oh,
I agree with you, right? But sorry, maybe Cyprian's out there. I don't know. I was actually when the topic for this panel came up, I thought, well, nuts. What am I going to talk about? I don't know what Web 2.0 is, so I went and looked it up. And it turns out that I actually direct a project that's a Web 2.0 project, and I didn't even know it. So for those of you who are sitting there going, what is Web 2.0? The way that I've come to understand it is, and this sort of builds on what John just said, that Web 1.0 was the static web page where you go to the web page and there's text on the web page and it's updated, you know, once a month or whenever the author gets there and updates it. It links to other pages, and that was really cool in the beginning because we didn't have anything else that did that. But that's, if you see a web page today and that's all it does, that's boring now, because the potential for the web now is that web page can interface to a database behind it. It can do things. You can go onto your computer and access your bank account. You can go onto your computer and use your web browser to create multimedia, which is something I'm going to show you later. You can, you know, do all of these things inside your web browser, because the web is now an interface to all these other systems. And that's basically, in a nutshell, where Web 2.0 is at the moment. Now, the grand idea of Web 2.0 may be beyond that, but basically the manifestation in the present physical world of Web 2.0 is that sort of thing, where you can use your web browser to do all kinds of stuff that your web browser itself doesn't do.
No arguments here. I think I would add that I like the idea of the term of Web 2.0 as a call to action in some ways, in that it, where you may have surfed the web in the past and simply been a consumer, as you mentioned previously, now there's a lot of impetus to start contributing in some small way. And I think I would go so far as to say, as if you're writing blog posts, that's one very good way to contribute. Some people may just want to take pictures and post them. That's another contribution. Mm-hmm. I'm tempted to say that even the process of reviewing something, so if you look at a site like Amazon and it says, what did you think of this book? Is it a 1-star or 5-star? I think that starts to turn the tide and say, mm-hmm. don't just sit there, give me something. And I wonder if this extends to things like all of the data on your iPod, for example. How many times have you listened to a podcast? Could you collect that off and feed it back somehow? So I find it quite convenient in that way. I am intrigued about Web 3.0, though, and where that goes next. And also, the backlash that you spoke about a little bit earlier of how far along are we going to march towards Web 2.0 before we start getting bogged down or sidetracked?
Well, I could pick a little bit of an argument. Anyway, I would say that, you know, if you classify use of a browser to access or interact with remote resources, I would draw a big distinction between, for example, Art Store, which we just saw, mm-hmm. and which, you know, I would say, no, that's not a Web 2.0 application. So what do I mean by that? I'd have to think about it. But primarily what I mean by it is it's not a two-way channel. You know, that was the point of my comment. I mean, you know, there are no annotations provided into the system by the people who use it. There's no organic growth happening there, right? It's all being produced and pushed out to an audience, right? Who are receiving that content in a container which was designed by the producer to limit the interaction with it to certain kinds of modes, right? So a Web 2.0 version of Art Store would have the following properties. Number one, you wouldn't have to ask the IT person how to discover the URL of an individual item so that you could share it with someone else, because it would be readily apparent. Number two, it would be possible, and you know, maybe this is a slightly bad example because of the copyright issues, but maybe it's not, because you know, that's the point of my question about Creative Commons, is that, you know, my notion of a Web 2.0 version of Art Store, for at least living artists, or for at least living artists who want their work to be alive and to be the center of active conversations, is that their works would be published with licenses that would anticipate the use by others of their material, right? That, you know, I want you to refer to my work. I want you, in some cases, if I've so licensed it, to republish it, right? To recombine it with other people's works and to derive new works from it, right? I want the conversations that happen about my work that I've placed into the space to be open to everyone, right? I want it to all grow organically. I want it to be connected to communities of interest. I want it to be connected to other communities of content that are related. I want patterns to be able to emerge from all of this stuff. You know, I want that process to occur, right? So I absolutely foresee a Web 2.0 version that is very different from Art Store. very different.
So I guess I was thinking of, I would agree with you about ArtStore, and I didn't mean that just being able to access a database makes it 2.0, but I'm thinking of being able to create something or complete something or a process that you normally would have to show up somewhere and do in person that you can now do on the web that requires more than just a website. I'm not expressing this very well.
Yeah. Oh, here's another what I would say requirement for me to classify ArtStore as a Web 2.0 application is it would explicitly offer, and this is a geeky technical term, it would offer an API, right, which is a word that means, I think, application programming interface. But what it boils down to is that a Web 2.0 version of ArtStore would not presume that there's one version of the interface, you know, which you like or don't like but are stuck with until, if you're lucky, 6 months later, the developers respond to your request and tune the interface to be what you wanted, right? Through the API, there would be the possibility for many other incarnations of that application to be built around the core services and around the core data. So, in fact, an example of that, although it was unintentional, is the thing that I showed you in the connection between Amazon and my public library, right? And on several levels, right? So, you know, Amazon, in fact, does explicitly make it possible to reach into someone's wish list with their permission and take their items and do something with them, right? So I could do that for any of you. If you gave me your Amazon wish list and you gave me the address of your library, I could actually make that magic happen for you as well. On the library side of it, though, and this has been interesting because this library lookup project that I've done is a case where the integration is possible just by virtue of the fact that many library catalogs are web applications, web 1.0 applications, I suppose. And it is possible in many cases to feed a URL into a library catalog, which includes an ISBN, and to get back the results of a lookup, right? Is this book in the library? Give me the result. The piece of work that I did was a kind of a guerrilla maneuver that exploited the fact that that was possible, although it was never anticipated by any vendor of any of the original OPAC systems, right? So it just, you know, it wasn't their idea that you could connect from Amazon into the public library, right? But it was, you know, being who I am and thinking about those kind of connections, I saw that it was possible and I made that connection. You know, what a Web 2.0 version of a library catalog would be is one that explicitly anticipated that scenario and not just didn't prevent the possibility, but actively encouraged the possibility, right? And thought about, you know, what are the ways in which this data that we have sitting inside of our library catalog might be repurposed by people? And in fact, since we can't even imagine what all those ways are, what we're going to do is provide some general mechanisms, you know, that are going to be, in fact, a kind of sandbox in which people can play.
So there may be a couple of things I hear here. One is that network effects get exploited by Web 2.0 to an unusual degree. That is to say, the synergy of having many people use things in different ways gets facilitated by Web 2.0. At the same time, Rachel, what I think I've heard is that telepresence, the projection of identity in a very compelling way online, and the opportunities for rich kinds of multimedia authoring and experiences online are also Web 2.0-esque. Are there meeting points between those two? Can we have rich presence and network effects, and is there a way to mash that up?
Sure.
I want to jump in here. One thing that I think I'm hearing is that the rate limiting step almost seems to be the user, as you mentioned earlier, and that would it be more interesting to change Web 2.0 to a verb and say, well, if you are capable, if the platform's capable of supporting it, why not Web 2.0 it? Why not change your perception of what you're willing to accept from ArtStore or from Amazon, as you did, or from any other application, and serve as a model for the rest of the community? I mean, that's a little bit fuzzy there, but I'm just...
No, I mean, it actually is. It is not. There's a guy at MIT called Eric Von Hippel, and he's written some scholarly papers on the open source process. And his latest book is... I think it's called user innovation. Anyway, that's his phrase, user innovation. You know, by which he means that although we think that a lot of technological innovation, you know, comes from the engineers and is simply given to the people who use their products, that the reality is that in many different domains, it's always the most engaged and advanced users of technology who are in fact, or in many cases, are in fact the source of innovation. And he studies this in you know, not just the IT domain, you know, where it's sort of obvious that, you know, open source hackers are taking software and adapting it to their own purposes. But he looks at examples as diverse as, you know, believe it or not, plumbing supply, right? Or sporting equipment. That's actually a pretty good one, right? He looks at the case of snowboarding and how it was always the leading snowboarders who were the ones who drove the innovation, right? Because the people who weren't snowboarders, you know, couldn't understand what was needed, right? It was the people who were doing the snowboarding that understood that. And so his conclusion, which is I think extremely interesting, is that what you want to then do is you want to provide people with, in fact, that what he calls a user innovation toolkit, or what you guys are calling a sandbox, right? That's a conscious strategy to enable innovation, right? That so, for example, his major example is GE Plastics, which apparently you know, found that it was limited in that it could only economically produce plastics, you know, for which there was a fairly large market, right? Because the design process was very expensive. So what they did was built a design toolkit. It kind of ties into your gaming theme, right? They built a simulation environment so that their customers could say, well, you know, I need a plastic that has these properties, and they said, fine, you know, we will give you a modeling and simulation toolkit that you can use to design something which we guarantee will be manufacturable. Right? And at that point, you know, instead of them being able to have a few large customers, they were able to now have a larger number of smaller customers, right? So this is, you know, this is the kind of decentralization that is possible, but it's about recognizing that you know, it is not, you know, we're not captives to the inventors of technology, right? They're not us, and they're not using it in the ways we do, and we ultimately we have the knowledge, right? And we just have to, you know, we have to have the expectation on the one hand that we articulate back to the people who provide the stuff what it is that we need and we want, but they have the obligation to craft the environments that they give us in ways that enable us to naturally express, you know, and evolve those needs, right? So
I want to get self-conscious here for a minute again. So we're sitting up here talking about Web 2.0, and it seems like when you talk about snowboarders or a small community of cutting-edge enthusiasts, that I'm wondering if you need an outsider to sit and say, that's significant, that modification that you've just done. That one's significant. Let's do another one. And if you project a little bit, in some ways we are starting to ask our students to do that a little bit. We're starting to say, go ahead and learn, but also tell me what it is you learned and how you learned. Can we program ourselves to be more innovative in that way? Is I guess the question.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Are you opening it up or?
Oh, we should. Yes, we should just not touch each other.
In some ways, it's kind of asking us to kind of redefine ourselves. You know, that we have to go from being 1.0 teachers to now being 2.0 teachers. You know, that and changing the relationship of us being the expert with the student. You know, we're giving all the information, and what you're saying is, you know, there has to be a qualitative change here in what's going on. And, you know, I don't know if I'm ready for that. I mean, as you're saying, you know, but I think that's the issue.
I wouldn't say that you have to. I'm saying you might want to.
Yeah, well.
And some reasons why you might want to, and this kind of ties to what Cyprian just said, would be that this process of, and you heard it from these guys in the development shop, right? This process of documenting your work, you know, narrating your work is one way that I describe it, is very powerful, you know, because it makes your life richer and more interesting in the long run, although it's not immediately apparent, right? But, you know, to the extent that these guys are blogging about their experiences with PHP Surveyor or what have you, there are network effects that occur, you know. And so I'm sure, you know, Jerry's been in the situation where out of the blue, some comment that he made on his blog about his experience with a piece of software resonated with somebody he'd never heard of, right, who made contact with him, right? And then there was a collaboration which occurred, right? It was, this is that sort of loose coupling that I was talking about, you know, that right now our worlds are constrained in a sense by sort of who we know, right? But when we are able to narrate our work in a public way, then there are more people who can know what we do. And if we welcome that, right, then, you know, suddenly you're in touch with a larger community of interest and without much effort, right? It's a very natural and organic process. You know,
but not only will other people know what we do, but I think we'll better know what we do.
Absolutely.
I would argue that students will learn a lot more and a lot more deeply if they do that reflection thing.
Absolutely.
Than if they just go through the motions that we usually...
Yeah, it's always about enlightened self-interest. Yeah. Always self-interest first, absolutely. Yeah.
And just to build on that, I don't think my expertise is best demonstrated by delivering content to a student. I think they think that. I think there are much deeper levels of expertise that I would like to participate in with them, just as I did with my best teachers. Content delivery was a very, very small part of that. Interesting.
I think one of the things that is happening now with blogging and wikis and Flickr is that voices that previously were not heard are being heard in a wide way, widely, because it's been very difficult for anyone other than academics to get their thoughts published. I mean, it's, you know, publishing is a big deal. You have to get someone to agree to do it, and it's all this work to write a book. And students didn't publish, and now students can publish in a way. And so I think that that there's a skill that's being learned, which is how to be public. I think that's something that faculty have traditionally, authors have traditionally learned at an older age, then people are going to need to learn it now. Because people can be published at a younger age and they're going to need to know how to have a public voice. And I think that can contribute back to the classroom, back to the course, in a very meaningful way, because these students can have their voices heard in a way that they just couldn't before. So,
might there be some drawbacks to that very breadth? As a professor, I spend a fair part of my time doing what librarians also do, helping students sift wheat from chaff. You know, this is a useful mm-hmm. website. This is a website made up by fakers who are denying the Holocaust.
Sure.
Teaching them how to make those distinctions.
Sure.
It seems to be like a large percentage of online blogs, self-burned CDs, e-books, self-published stuff could actually benefit from some peer review.
Of course it could.
I think that's very true. And it's been said that if you want to be an author, you have to write a million pages of crap before you write anything good.
Do you have to publish the million is the question.
You don't have to publish the million. But my point was going to be that if you do publish it and you get peer review, maybe you can get away with it in 500,000 words of crap.
Well, and my point would be the work of evaluation that you've done to help those students sift the wheat from the chaff is in principle shareable, right? In other words, if you did that communication in a private mode, you know, then the next person who encounters those web pages has no more information about them than they did before, right? If you did that evaluation in a public mode, the next person who does a search that encounters those web pages is extremely likely to also find the evaluation that you published. Extremely likely, right? So now you've added something actually of great value to the communal space, right? And that is how it is possible for something as counterintuitive as the Wikipedia to work. And it's completely counterintuitive on the face of it, right? I mean, it seems like anti-gravity, right?
You do have some. You can peer review on the web by doing things like writing reviews, like you mentioned, by linking to certain things.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, I need to teach my students how those tools now work. I mean, I'm not just trying to separate the wheat from the chaff. I'm trying to teach them how to do that separation.
Right.
And so where's Web 2.0 going to have me doing that?
Well, I would say that the same, if there were nothing inherently proprietary or confidential about this conversation, about that set of resources, then I would always gravitate toward doing the work in a public space. Just because it serves all of the same purposes, right? In other words, I can always communicate in the same way to a smaller audience, you know, without precluding the possibility of also communicating to a global audience, right? And if I leave that second possibility open, then there are serendipitous effects which are possible that otherwise are foreclosed. Options would otherwise be foreclosed, right? So, you know, that I always try to flip that switch in the direction of greater inclusion when possible.
I might add, I'm leaning towards, looking towards your discipline as well. It feels like we're getting much broader representation from different disciplines as they come online and start embracing a lot of these tools. And in some ways, the disciplinary rules that you learned as you became a professor and instructor and researcher will start to work their way into the blogs of your students, I think. I'm hopeful about that, anyways.
John, I got to tell you, leaving your presentation today, I was totally depressed.
Uh-oh.
And that is, I came to the realization that I need to work on optimizing my information time. I need serious help on that. Otherwise, I'll never reach Web 2.0. I will never be Web 2.0 compliant. So, I'd like to hear all of you respond to this proposition. And if you disagree with the proposition, then you have to provide alternatives to the proposition.
That's
right. So here's the thing. He's a debate coach.
That's good.
She said yesterday that she likes rules.
That's right.
When I know what they are, but go ahead, please, tell us the rules.
Here's my proposition. I just want Google to organize my life.
You know, they want to organize your life too.
Yeah. They're actually managing my mortgage for me now. You know, it's working out really well.
But they don't want the overhead. They want to make it possible for you to do it. Really, is what they want.
Sure.
With what are we to disagree or agree?
Yeah.
You either need to say they're the best out there, go with it, or that's really dangerous. Here's the alternative.
That's kind of a personal decision.
Well, say more.
But is the impetus that you are feeling information overload, and in other words,
sure.
is your depression that I couldn't keep track of that much stuff on my own?
Yeah, but I'm really psyched about Google Calendar because it's starting to integrate things in a way that weren't possible before.
Right, me too.
Deal with the functionality integration trade-off. The more functionality I get, the less it's integrated, and the more dangerous things become for me. So Google is sort of like, hey, they're starting to do these things, and I'm feeling really comfortable with that. So I want you to say either I should be comfortable with that, and that's okay, or Tim, don't get comfortable with that. There are these other alternatives out there. Here's what you ought to expect.
I think you should definitely have a Google exit strategy in mind in case they turn to the dark side.
Right?
Which they may.
But so far, I've satisfied myself that I can get my data out of them in the ways that I need to. Right, which is actually, and that's another sort of, I would say, Web 2.0 principle, right, is that, the data that I contribute, in some sense, I own. You know, I may co-own it with the service into which I've contributed that data, but it's mine, right? You're not going to lock me in and not let me get my data back out. That's critical, right? Just walk away from any service that presents you with that proposition, because that is evil. Don't do that.
Yeah. You had commented before that Web 2.0 technologies in a way empower individual voices. I look at it in the opposite way. I think Web 2.0 technologies promote such a rapid change in ideas, a rapid rate of evolution of an idea, that individual voices get lost in that. It's almost like as if everybody's talking at one time. And nobody's listening to one person at any given moment. I just want your thoughts.
Can I?
Please.
So I was kind of curious. You were talking about an individual voice, and I guess separating it out from the front end of an idea. Is it important that individuals get credit back for an idea, or?
Oh, no, not for me. For me, not necessarily. That's my point. My point is that the individual isn't empowered,
uh-huh.
that the individual voice, in a way, is lost. That is my point. It's not important for me, necessarily.
Okay. So I'm tempted to say that you'll, in this more rapidly moving evolution, perhaps you can work through many, many more ideas much more quickly in a way that you couldn't have in the past.
Well, there are definitely hyper-acceleration effects, and there is the continuous partial attention syndrome, right? Which is a term that was coined by Linda Stone, who was at Apple and at Microsoft. And this is a real issue. And in fact, you're starting to see now a certain amount of backlash against even the very idea of multitasking. And I will tell you that, you know, in fact, I'm pretty much of a single tasking kind of person, and maybe that's how I managed to get a lot of things done. You know, I actually don't divide my attention stream into microseconds, you know, and I actually don't spend hardly any time when I am, you know, and I'm pretty careful to choose the modes that I use and to be focused on getting things done. There's lots of distraction, right? There's lots of confusion. And I mean, if you think about it, right, as a species, we've had for, I don't know, 100,000 years, essentially, one mode of communication, speech, right? And then the relatively new innovation was writing. And then in sort of rapid succession, right, we have all these different modes to contend with. And it is, in fact, crazy, right? I mean, you know, what's the appropriate thing in this situation? You know, is it an IM? Is it an email? Is it Skype? Is it right? You know, how should I be notified? You know, where should we collaborate on? You know, which wiki, right? Which flavor of wiki? Right? I mean, there's certainly a lot of noise and confusion, no question, right? I mean, yeah.
But isn't that where filters come in?
Yes.
You know, and before this epoch, I would never have had any chance of hearing those voices. And now, if I listen carefully or if I apply certain filters, I hear those voices.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody translate filters for the rest of us? Translate filters. What do you mean filters?
So what's a filter?
What do you mean by filter?
The easiest way I can think of that is going back to at the lunch session, there were four blogs that we were shown. Okay, of reputable people who usually have interesting, important things to say.
Exactly.
Okay, John's a filter, okay, for example. That way. We used to call them experts, right? And now, maybe there's a different name for them.
That's actually true, and it works in both directions. So some of those people that you refer to are filters for me relative to things going on in the educational domain that I'm not that close to. So this is actually a very important point that is not evident until or unless you get into this mode of using a blog reader.
Right? Yeah,
and
yeah,
are subscribed
and
to these sources.
That's a filter too,
right,
in a more mechanical sort of way.
Right.
You know, and
Betsy, I'm sorry. Rachel, go ahead, and then Betsy's going to jump in.
My comment and question was building off of Steve's over there. And it has more, it's more of a kind of philosophical, because what it seems to me that we're seeing is a change in our conceptualization of the self. You know, I mean, this is, you know, all of us professor types, we've built our careers on a really 19th century notion of who we are as individuals and the kind of work that we do. You know, I was trying to go through the MLA handbook to try to even cite web pages. It's really clunky. And this idea of kind of an interactive environment where the self really loses a lot of importance. And I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm seeing. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't think that's the case. I think that, in fact, it's a return. We're beginning to get the mechanisms that enable us to return, in fact, to more tribal ways of being human beings, right? And so, I mean, when we lived in tribes in close physical proximity to one another, we had, in fact, a high degree of awareness about what was going on, you know, relative to other members of our tribe, right? Because you could see them and you could hear them, you could smell them, right? And now, and then along comes the internet, right? And we have this period where we have suddenly got this strange situation of we're in association with people, You know, but it's extremely attenuated, right? You know, I mean, I actually have a number of people that I consider to be professional colleagues who I've never met, right? Ever, and may never meet, right, in person. But actually consider myself to be, you know, working closely with, right? But you know, what needs to come back together now is, you know, we need to enrich the medium in a way that the sorts of signals that enabled us to be aware of one another and to react to one another are relayed more, you know, more effectively. And you know, the media is part of that, you know, and the sort of the acceleration of communication. But I would argue that, you know, that the notion of self is the same, right? It was interesting to hear the discussion about wikis in that sense, and that may be part of what you're referring to, because one of the reasons why wikis are a good tool for people to work with on possibly contentious issues, right, is that they actually, you know, the wiki is a mode that you choose when you want to de-emphasize individual voices, right, and when you want, in fact, to move toward consensus, right? Whereas blogs are all about, you know, this is literally the projection of myself, yeah, right? This is, you know, I am narrating who I am and what I am.
A blog is different than, you know, our kind of romantic notion of the artist, you know, or the author, who is alone in his or her studio creating.
See, I disagree with that.
No, I disagree with that.
Not interacting as much. This is very different. I mean, because this is not only, I mean, your ideas, you know, I mean, and there, you, of course, you know, we all know great theorists have said, you know, no wonder, you know, what is an author? We all go back to that. But you know, do you see what I'm saying? That if this Web 2.0, this kind of completely interactive environment, everything is public domain. I mean, do you know what I mean? There.
But what do you mean by public domain? You mean in a sense of ownership?
At what point?
In a sense of accreditation? In a sense of you know, what do you mean by public domain?
Talking about seeing, you know, someone else's blog or someone else's artwork and building upon that and changing it and you know, and everyone's doing this all at, you know, simultaneously.
Right.
That I think that fundamentally changes the way we perceive ourselves in relationship to others. And I guess my point is that, and it had a little bit to do with what Dennis is gone now. Is that it changes the way we think about our teaching too?
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think so too. Because I mean, culture has always progressed by building on the past, right? It's just that when you accelerate that process by orders of magnitude, you know, maybe a difference in degree becomes a difference in kind, right? And that's, right. I think that's an interesting question.
I would say that process has been going on for a long time that way. It's just happening a lot faster now. The French Impressionist painters knew each other. They wrote to each other. They dropped by each other's studios. They went to the same parks and painted together. They saw what they were doing. They saw what each other were. I'm not sure the grammar there, but, you know, they all knew what the other people were working on.
They were a tribe.
And they were in a tribe, and their work was influenced by what they saw and what they talked about, and when they, you know, argued about what color this light was or that light was. And that happened. It just happened slower. And it took longer to finish a piece, and if you wanted to build off of someone else's piece, you couldn't take an instant copy of it and change it. You had to actually create something from the ground up that included both whatever you were building off of and your new stuff, and it just took a lot longer. And I believe that creative process has been that way in many fields for a long, long time. I think authors do the same thing. It's just faster now because, as you say, you can go and find a piece of digital art that you like. I can find a photograph that I like, and I can incorporate it into one of my digital postcards and build off of that, and I can do that a lot faster than if we were all painting with oils.
Faster is not necessarily better.
And I'm not making, right, a judgment whether
it might
be better or not.
In some cases, or in many cases.
But I think it's different. I think it's faster.
Yeah.
And I think it does affect how we develop ourselves. And I think that it goes along with the idea that culture is more complicated now. Is that speed is where we are. That's what we're used to. That's where we're more comfortable there because we built up to it slowly, sort of.
I've got a question. How do you think that the Web 2 is going to affect research? There's a bill in Congress, I don't know whether it's died or what's happened to it, but it's bound to come back. The bill basically says that any research that's publicly funded is going to have to be put on the web 6 months after it's been published on a hard copy. Well, it's going to eventually pass the hard copy. Okay. So now, right now, if you publish something, if you're in science, you've got a small group of peers who review it. Now it's going to go out there. I'm wondering what you think that's going to fundamentally change science to some degree.
Is it? Do you really have to wait 6 months before you put it up?
Well, that's what the bill now. But I mean, there's bound to be something eventually come out.
It's going to change publishing more than science.
Well, one thing is, something John said, that now it's going to be out there. Before, when it gets published, maybe a half dozen or even four professionals say it's okay, it's out there, it's good. And then it's never touched again unless somebody has some research. Now it's going to be out there, not ever having been put in a hard copy, and people are going to play with it.
That's kind of a jump. I mean, unless I misunderstood what you said, it sounded like the bill was saying that after it's published, it needs to be put on the web.
Yes.
And then we've made the jump to now it's going to be on the web before it's published.
It would seem to me that it won't be long until it'll no longer be published, because Steve is right. It will change fundamentally the publishing industry. And so eventually you're just going to put your stuff right out on the web.
So this is in some academic communities, this has been happening already for a long time, in particular physics and computer science, right? So LANL, the Los Alamos National Labs, has had for what? How long? How long has the LANL archive been up? Anyone know?
At least 10 years, right?
Yeah, before. Right. So for 10 years, it's been the case that pre-publication stuff is out there on LANL for the computer scientists and for the physicists, right? I personally see nothing wrong with that, and would love to see that be universally the case. I mean, one of the interesting things I've observed about the blogging community is that it's got curiously sort of academic instincts, and I don't think this is really widely recognized. But you know, I often notice that an article in a newspaper will never cite primary sources, but you know when
the
you
blogs
but
do.
The but the blogs always do, right?
They
it's actually
do.
An instinct, you know, to cite primary sources
and not take credit for something that's not yours,
right?
Because
right.
it's visible that it's not yours, and someone's going to call you on it,
right?
I want to come back to the notion of tribes, though, for publicly dissecting scientific data. And it strikes me that the tribes presumably will start. Could start within a discipline. How many people can understand the physics papers that are published these days? Probably the people who have trained as physicists, and maybe one or two talented amateurs, but probably not many beyond that, I'm guessing, unless you put a fair bit of effort and earn your way into a tribe, perhaps.
Well, here's something to think about, is we don't have a lot of opportunities in our culture for apprenticeship. In fact, hardly any, right? And so I would say that one of the benefits, I mean, if we got to a place where people who were professionals in any field, you know, sort of thought routinely about narrating their work, and there was this transparency, and there was this ability to collaborate online with others, you know, then part of what you would see is you would see how the mind of a person in that profession works and evolves, right? That is to say, if you were interested, you could in effect, apprentice yourself to that person to some degree. But, you know, before, let's say, making the commitment to, you know, go into that field, let's say, or to just try to do it independently, right? We have very, very few opportunities to observe others at work in our culture, right? And that's one of the tribal loops that we haven't closed
right,
in, right?
Right.
We used to be able to, because that's how we learn, right? We learn by watching how others work. And we don't get to see that happen. We don't get to experience that very much. So opening that up, I think could be a tremendous benefit.
What a marvelous teaching model that would be.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of, in particular, Darcy's blog, Darcy Norman's blog,
for example,
where he spends the morning trying to figure out a piece of hardware, a piece of software, and then he writes it all up, and it's there. And if you do a Google search on that software because you're trying to figure it out, there's Darcy's step by step. Well, I tried this first, and for heaven's sake, don't try that because it didn't work.
But more than that, you have the ability then to know what is it like to be an instructional technologist. What is that like? You can know that.
What do you do day to day?
Right.
A couple of hands up in this area, John, and then you, and then you.
I don't know if the use of tribal terminology was deliberately McLuhan-esque or not, but if it was, he wrote many years ago that the oral age was a tribal age, and the move to literacy created a time of private identity. And in his time, television was supposedly moving us back in the direction of a tribal identity because it de-emphasized writing and it emphasized speech as a medium. So given your comments about Web 2.0 going in the direction of tribalizing us again, I wonder how you square that with the comment you made in your keynote address where you talked about the web and blogging really being a medium of writing rather than a visual medium or an oral medium.
So it's been an interesting thing for me in the last couple of years because I always was a writer in the sense of producing text. But now, just very recently, I'm in a mode where I'm as likely to be creating audio or, in some cases, video. And so I've actually thought a lot about the degree to which we compartmentalize disciplines like, newspapers and radio and television according to the nature of the medium in which the stuff is composed, right? So, people think of them as writers, or they think as audio people, or they think as video people. But yet, it in fact is converging, right? So if you work at a radio station, you're likely to have a blog now. You're doing more writing than you used to do, right? So those those boundaries were in some way artificial, right? And it doesn't feel significantly different to me to be composing in audio than to be composing in text.
From the standpoint of the question that was raised earlier about identity, what writing created that speech didn't is the opportunity to preserve and to hold on to production of text. And in the move that's happened since, all kinds of text now can be preserved, and they can also be shared.
Yes.
And you open up this tension between the tribal urge, which existed primarily in a world where texts couldn't be preserved and they had to be shared as a group, because through the group collective mind, you have the possibility of fully recreating the text.
Yes.
In writing, an individual can preserve an entire text and hold it and shape it and keep it and decide who gets access to it. And so it now becomes an expression of private identity because you don't need the rest of the group. Now we're going in the direction of the web where the original text becomes a new text, becomes a new text, becomes a community text. And it creates a sort of interesting tension between privacy and identity and public domain and the group domain.
So two things. First of all, the original text doesn't necessarily morph. Right. The original text, is ideally, in my view, overlaid with annotations which are discoverable from the original text. Nobody changes my words, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge thing with me, and that's in fact why I'm still struggling with the issue of comments on my blog, right? My blog, in fact, is my space. It is the projection of my identity, and I very strongly feel that, and I don't want other people writing in my space and tampering with my stuff, and I'm only in wikis for the purpose of being in an environment where it's appropriate to be doing that, right? So that's one. Two is that the tools that we're starting to have now for the manipulation of audio and video are allowing them to become as malleable as text. Right? And we're not quite there yet in terms of this, the ability to scan or index into the stuff, right? But but they are becoming more interchangeable in that sense, right? So the what you said is absolutely true about needing to write it down in order to preserve it, but increasingly it's becoming true that recording it is preserving it, right? And then we have the tools to add these layers of annotation on top of that.
And, you know, you've used the word sharing a couple of times. One of the things that's interesting for me is the way in which these tools allow the sharing to become itself a text that we can read. It's always been there. We call it civilization. But now, almost as if it's a time-lapse photograph, we can start to read the sharing itself as a kind of a text. And it's hard not to get all hippified when you think about this, but if we could think about sharing as a text, that exemplifies the best of what
but
we can do.
That's another level of the complexity. I can't remember who said it, but the phrase when it came out made me think of a contrary phrase, which is the people I wish to know, because there's a whole wide world out there of people that I'm not particularly concerned that they know me or I know them. And it seems that in the direction that we're going, the bottom line assumption is community is always good, and discovering new people is always good, and I guess I've just reached an age in my life where I'm enough of a crank to think that
I'm not fool enough to respond to any of that.
Okay.
Our next contestant, yes.
Well, I really enjoyed the comments of everyone on Web 2.0, and just some observations and... And we're in a situation where we have process and product. And the process is kind of like a wave that we're riding, but don't have a whole lot of control over, maybe a little bit. And the thing that interests me is that it's ubiquitous. And there's a lot of democratization and kind of making the world a smaller place that goes along. And it's affecting everyone's life. Just as a side note, one of the first uses of the internet that I ever saw was at the salvage store for auto parts, where they used to have an old teletype, and does anybody have a transmission for a Model A Ford? This is not just solely in academia, and as we know when we go to CompUSA, how has it affected my life, Tim? It's made for less clutter. I don't have to keep track of all my service manuals. So when the washing machine or the dishwasher needs a little attention, I can go online and look it up and get the manual that I've somehow stuck somewhere where God only knows where it's in my study, perhaps. And we want to go and find out where the workplace is, or get on MapQuest or Google Maps. And it has really facilitated how everyone is doing things. And as lifelong learners, the church newsletter, the dog club, where is the dog meat? Get on the web, and why hasn't the web been updated? Oh, that was last year's annual picnic. I mean, this is just pervasive, and I think it's been, even with television, with all the cable channels now, the Learning Channel, the History Channel. I mean, if they had taught history like that when I was growing up, and if I could have looked at the history of General Motors, that was pretty fascinating. With all the visuals and multimedia, it's kind of a whole package, and so I think academia has kind of a unique role to play in that we're reflective, collaborative, imaginative, and can help steer this whole process, which I think has some promise. You know, it's a real promise to help future generations. So anyway, that's kind of my take, and we're not living in a bubble, certainly.
A couple more hands up, Anna, and then Ralph.
I'm really taken with a number of strands that have been occurring through the day, and the sense of transformation from, as you were mentioning in the keynote, from being consumer to producer. This also sense of Web 2.0, of it being demand-driven, and I'm thinking about academic applications, and certainly of my role as a faculty member in the classroom. You know, there's a lot of variety in the way the classrooms are handled and discussions are handled, but it's supply-driven. And I control what goes on in that classroom, and I control what tools they have and what access they have. I'm thinking about after the transformation, maybe this is academic 3.0 or Web 3.0, or however that analogy plays itself out. Thinking about what the possibilities might be, I'm wondering if faculty are really ready for the idea that students truly embrace universally this being demand-driven, that they can start calling the shots about what it is that they want. And now, at this stage, we're not really ready for that, because we know that students are asking for things that we know they don't really need. That's what we tell ourselves at times. They want us to give them content. We realize they don't need just content. They need to learn how to deal with that content or manage it in different ways. But what happens when they go through that transformation and they view their role very differently? What happens in the classroom, either both in the ideal sense and also maybe in the not so ideal sense. I mean, what does that mean for me? Am I now a filter instead of an expert? Instead of leading discussion, am I there as a participant? And where do we go? If we truly get the universal sense where it's not just a few early adopters calling the shots, but everyone calling the shots and it really being demand-driven.
Who said that they felt like a consultant? That was you, right? So wasn't Socrates a consultant? Essentially? Right? Yeah. I think that's where you want to be. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? I mean, that's where you want to be. So...
Dead.
You know, well, I have a question.
I'm not a current teacher. I'm not going to... That's personal. Never mind.
No, say it. Oh, you can't stop now.
Okay. Honestly, with everything that's happened since Socrates was alive, do you really want to be Socrates? Or do you want to be different from Socrates?
I just mean in his mode of, you know...
And that's what I'm saying. Is education still that? Is it still that? Is that the best that we can do?
Are we doing
or
it now?
Or can we go somewhere beyond that?
Are we doing it now?
See, I don't think we are. I think we did it for a while, and then we're doing this other thing. But my point is, do you want is the thing that you want to say, I want to teach like Socrates? Is that... And if it is, great, but... Think about it before you.
No, that's okay. That's so here's what I would yeah. suggest is that you know, to the extent that content delivery has been an important mode, I would say that there is the opportunity to shift that into other modes, you know, that are consumable in ways more convenient to the student at times and in ways of their choosing, right? You know, such that they arrive in the class for an engagement. You know, with the instructor and with the other students in the class, mm-hmm. which is informed by the absorption of that other material. And, you know, actually, I'll ask you guys all this who are teachers, because I would so kill to be going back to school now. I mean, I went to college in the mid-1970s, and, you know, I still think about how cool it would be if I had been able to record some of the performances of Ralph Williams, you know, this professor at the, I don't know, you may know of him. Yeah, right? I mean, I was in Ralph Williams' great books class, right? And it was just, you know, I wish I could have bottled those performances and could re-experience them now. You know, if I were in his class today, in fact, it's an interesting question. Would I be allowed to? Right? I would want to. You know, And
there's another side to that. There are moments in the classroom when a student finally gets it or asks a question that I could never have anticipated. If I could freeze that and say, now, let's rewind that. Do you see something happen there? Students don't understand when their cognition takes that turn, in part because they're in the moment.
Yeah.
But one of the ways I, as a teacher, can add value to their experience is to say, look what happened there. Here's what I see. What do you see? How could that happen again? And make them self-aware, which is part of what we're trained to do, I think. So, yeah. Would we be allowed to do that? I don't know. You know, students, there is also in the classroom a necessary feeling of privacy.
Yep.
That there's room for them not to get it and not to have their mistakes recorded.
Yeah.
I figure I'm committed. All my mistakes are propagating themselves in ways that I'll never be able to control again. But, you know, that's what it means to be a professional. What do you do with students and their need for a place to develop in private?
Yep.
Yeah.
Kind of goes back to the earlier point about, you know, is transparency necessarily good? Right? And it's problematic. You know, but it is certainly the case that the general expectation is for more transparency. Right? You know, we're all inexorably moving in the direction of leading lives that are more transparent, that are more discoverable by other people. And with that comes, you know, a level of accountability that can be frightening. Right? And so, yeah, you know, the need to you know, go shields up, is a big issue, right? You know, but that's also sort of part of learning you know, learning how to draw these boundaries, like I think you were talking about, right? You know, it's like, when, you know, when do I shut down the IM, right? When do I
answer the phone?
Right. When do I make the decision not to check email today, and so on, right? And then, you know, these again are sort of, you know, learned behaviors, right? That you know, people have to have suggested to them, because it's not right. It's very easy to get sucked into the into the cycle, right?
It reminds me of something that comes up a lot in the gaming conversation, which is about avatars. And an avatar is basically, technically, it's your 3D representation in a virtual world, but it can be anything that represents you in whatever space that you're in. And every now and then, I get in these situations where, as are we all, I'm in different worlds. I'm a mother and a wife and a student and a, you know, employee and all these different things. And every now and then, these worlds just kind of go, you know, in the weirdest ways. Some of them, you're like, okay, you have the boss over to dinner. I can cope with that. But then every now and then I'm giving a lecture and I'll mention World of Warcraft and somebody will go, what server are you on? And I'll tell them, and it turns out that, you know, we ran past each other that morning or something. And it's just like, whoa. And how do I, in a world of increasing transparency, how do I keep those boundaries where they need to be kept? Because, you know, people have been coming up to me and saying, remarking on something that I wrote about, a personal experience that I wrote about in my blog, and I put that up there and then I forget, you know, that any of you could see it. And then you come up and you're like, and I read that, and I'm just going, you did? Wow.
Should we keep those boundaries?
And yeah, what's the boundary the there? You know, does that gives us a connection that I didn't know we had until just now, and what do I do with that? So where do we want the boundaries? Where do we want the transparency?
They are up to you.
Yeah.
And different people will put the boundaries at different places.
They will.
Yeah. And I've drawn mine, for example, along the lines of not talking about personal stuff, basically. I mean, you know, my blog is, in fact, a record of my professional life, you know, by choice. And it is, you know, that, right, that there's no need, you know, for me to talk to the world about my family, right? There is a need to talk to the world about my work.
A couple of quick questions, and then Dr. Roth, yeah, go ahead.
It strikes me, as I listen to us explore these ideas, that, you know, an awful lot of people in the history of the world have grown up in one-room cabins, and that changes everything, you know? But we're all used to our little rooms and our spaces and my study and my corner, and it doesn't mean that we should all get used to living in the one-room cabin all the time. But it is useful to know that some perfectly successful living has happened.
But were they really fulfilled? Yeah.
What server were they on?
Their own server.
That's what I'm saying.
They're on a server all to themselves.
Okay, Raul. Oh, just by listening to you and a lot of the comments here, it just reminds me of the days when I was in engineering. I was an engineer in a past life, and yes, I was a programmer. Now I'm teaching business. And it was very common in my engineering years to collaborate. And nobody really owned anything. We all always try to solve a problem, and we rejoice achieving a goal. Obviously, in the business world, you are supposed to profit from when you own your idea. If not, you're a fool, or you're fired, and as seen on TV. So, I wonder if the marketing aspect of the Web 1.0 migrating into this open world of the Web 2.0 is going to be an interesting model for everybody. I mean, it's about time for business to start changing, too. I don't know, it's just a thought.
Yep. If we have more time, there is a much longer and more interesting discussion to have there about drawing intellectual property boundaries. And, you know, this kind of gets back, I think, to the Creative Commons piece of the puzzle, right? That, you know, there is material which is necessarily confidential and proprietary. In that case, it should never be exposed to the public web. And that's, you know, there's a whole culture of security that's growing up around making that possible. But, you know, there's a counterincentive to holding ideas privately. There was some sociologist who did a study and compared the culture of Route 128 Boston to Silicon Valley. And the question was, you know, why actually did Silicon Valley become the nexus of all of this innovation? And her contention, I don't know how you could prove this, was that the two cultures differed in the following way, which was that people on the East Coast tech center were pretty insular, right? And you know, the engineers went to work, you know, maybe they collaborated with each other and they went home, right? And in Silicon Valley, they went to work, they collaborated with each other, and then they went out to the bar and they hung out with people. You know, HP people hung out with Apple people and so on.
Married each other.
And there was, well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, so they were walking a line, right? I mean, there was, you know, there was always the danger, and I'm sure in a number of occasions there was, you know, there were leakages of intellectual property, right? But on the whole, right, that cross-fertilization was what made that tech culture be the one that really sprouted. So
I think it's fair to say that as these things continue at this accelerated pace, and things is about vague enough to cover all of what we're talking about, it could tear itself to pieces, just like civilization. Or some synergy could come out of it. Just some food for thought as we end the panel discussion. A panel is synergy. That panel is assembled because of synergies that involve online and face-to-face interaction. The time we have shared together is documented on the blog. You can continue to add to that, and I hope one day we all meet again.
So what's over everyone?